This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. As officials in Washington and the neighboring state of Virginia brace for the anniversary of a white nationalist rally that exploded in deadly violence in Charlottesville, Virginia last year, Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser is reacting.
Whether they are spewing hatred and racism online on the nation's capital, let us speak in one voice and tell them that they are wrong.
Organizers of last year's rally in Charlottesville were not able to get permission to hold another rally this year, but they were okayed to have a similar rally here in Washington across from the White House today. At last year's rally in Charlottesville, a 32-year-old counter-protester, Heather Heyer, was killed by a self-described white supremacist who rammed the car into a crowd at high speed. Sporadic clashes raged for a third day Sunday for the control of Afghanistan's southeastern city of Ghazni and amid conflicting claims about whether the government of the Taliban insurgency controlled key installations. Afghan security forces remained in control of all the strategic positions there in Ghazni, including the office of the provincial governor, police headquarters, the main prison, and the office of the Afghan spy agency. Rudy Giuliani, U.S. President Donald Trump's attorney, said that his legal team will not allow special counsel Robert Mueller to question Mr. Trump about his firing last year of former FBI Director James Comey. Comey, at the time Trump ousted him in May of 2017, was chief of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and heading the agency's investigation of Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. That led to the conjecture whether Mr. Trump obstructed justice in trying to thwart the Russia probe. Days after ousting Comey, Trump said he was thinking of this Russia thing when he decided to dismiss him. Mueller was soon appointed to take over the Russia probe. This is VOA News. The White House is responding to claims by former presidential advisor Omarosa Manigault that U.S. President Trump is a racist and that she has tapes of him using a racial slur toward black people. During an interview on NBC's Meet the Press, Manigault said that Mr. Trump was heard saying the word as he filmed the Apprentice reality series.
Once I heard it for myself, it was confirmed what I feared the most, that Donald Trump is a con and has been masquerading as someone who is actually open to engaging with diverse communities. But when he talks that way, the way he did on this tape, it confirmed that he is truly a racist.
But on Fox News Sunday, White House counselor Kellyanne Conway said Omarosa is not credible.
She told ABC News the day after she was fired that she had resigned. She's now saying she was fired. She told ABC News the day after she was fired that quote, Donald Trump, no, he's not a racist, that she wouldn't have been there.
Manigault is currently promoting her book Unhinged, which is to be released this week. The Parker Solar Probe was launched Sunday in a mission to venture closer to the sun than ever before.
1-0. Liftoff.
This is the moment NASA launched its expedition to, quote, touch the sun.
A daring mission to shed light on the mysteries of our closest star, the sun.
The Parker Solar Probe was launched on board a Delta IV heavy rocket from Cape Canaveral on Sunday. Its seven-year mission will bring it to within 3.8 million miles of the solar surface. That might sound like a lot, but it's seven times closer than any previous spacecraft. The probe will travel into the sun's solar corona. That's the hazardous region of intense heat and solar radiation that you can see during an eclipse. There, it'll be up against temperatures reaching nearly 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, or 1,370 degrees Celsius.
The man who authorities say stole a commercial airliner in the U.S. state of Washington worked for Horizon Air, and some ask why the plane was not locked to prevent such incidents. The 29-year-old worked for Horizon Air and helped handle luggage and towing aircraft. Authorities say he had worked Friday, was in uniform, and he got into the cockpit of the plane and took off. Paul Pastor is the sheriff of the county in which all of this happened.
It was a very small two-prop plane, commuter aircraft, was stolen. The person who stole it was either doing something as a kind of a lark, or perhaps he was trying to harm himself.
Sheriff Pastor said there were no indications of terrorist intent. A family friend read a statement saying they are shocked and devastated. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
They are calling on him to resign, basically with the moral ground. And now he has defected from that minority party. He wants to look into the constitution and defend the Republic of Nigeria on that.
Officials of the Nigerian ruling party demand the resignation of Senate President Bukola Saraki.
We agree that this monitoring committee should come and meet very quickly so that together we can identify what are the concrete tasks that we need to achieve and build an agenda.
Togolese opposition groups await the arrival of regional leaders to help resolve the ongoing political crisis.
On the material day, Wednesday the 8th, he did come to the office, the party headquarters, to collect his adoption certificate. Much to our chagrin, he disappeared. And the only thing that we knew was that he had not traveled to Chipata, which is about 600 kilometers east.
A Zambian main opposition parliamentary candidate goes into hiding, citing intimidation and harassment. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The chairman of the Nigerian ruling party, the All Progressives Congress, or APC, has called on the president of the Senate, Bukola Saraki, to resign. At a news conference Friday, Chairman Adams Oshiomhole promised to impeach the Senate president if he fails to honorably resign. But this drew sharp criticism from the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, which condemned his pronouncement as unfortunate and regrettable. This after the Senate president recently announced defection to the main opposition party. For analysis, I reach Abdul Rahim Balogun, assistant editor-in-chief with the News Agency of Nigeria in the capital, Abuja.
They are calling on him to resign. I think basically it's a moral ground. And now he has defected from that minority party. He wants to look into the constitution and defend the Republic of Nigeria on that. The constitution says there have been various interpretations of three or two sections of the constitution on that. If there's no division within your party, you cannot leave. Or else you declare your seat vacant. That is one. If you decide to now leave, you have to resign from a particular leadership position in which you are benefiting currently. I think it's based on either of these positions that APC at the national level is asking Dr. Bukola Saraki to vacate the seat and allow the ruler to take his course.
But do you see Bukola Saraki resigning, looking at the current situation on the ground?
I don't see him resigning. If you recall, in 2015, when he emerged as the second president, one, the party operated on supporting on a turning formula. The Senate presidency was going to North East. Bukola Saraki is from North Central. But due to some arrangement, Bukola Saraki is not from North Central. And they called on him to step down. He refused. He said the majority appointed him, elected him, and to be the leader. And he cannot advocate. But what people are saying now is that the minority leader, the former minority leader in the Senate, the president of Senator Gosi Akpabio also left the party, left PDP and then APC, and resigned into opposition as a minority whip and a leader of opposition in the House. They are now saying Bukola Saraki retained that line of honor by honorably resigning. So, in one word, I don't see Bukola Saraki resigning.
How are Nigerians reacting to this political intrigue following news that the head of national security, talking about Daura, who was fired by the acting president, Professor Osibanjo, for what most people said was the invasion by the national security at the Senate?
Oh, of course, Nigeria are happy with that decision. It was a unanimous condemnation all over, either from majority or minority party. I think Nigerians are agreeing that that was a terrible act. It's a slap on democracy. And as a result of that, it is something condemnable. And Nigerians are in total agreement and total support to the decision of the acting president, Professor Yemi Osibanjo, Basari Daura, and instituting a co-panel to find out what could have caused that and recommend to the government to for such a thing in the future. I think it was a welcoming development.
Now, I understand some Nigerians are saying that the invasion, so to speak, of the National Assembly plays into the hands of Bukola Saraki, who is being pressured by APC stalwarts for him to resign on moral grounds, as you said. Some people are saying now he looks like the man who is defending Nigeria's democracy in the eye of the storm, they said. Your take?
That is true. You know, it's in the realm of speculation. But I want to plead with Nigerians to tarry a while and await the outcome of the poll panel on that matter. The outcome of the poll panel will unveil those behind that chain, whether it was because it was not the presidential directly. And this information has become counter-information from both parties. The APC members are not in national assembly that day. They were estimating that for PDP members who normally come to work around 10 to be there at 3 a.m. 10 a.m., that goes to show that they are aware that such a thing was going to happen. And they should ask them, what are they coming to this office? 7 a.m. in the morning.
Abdulrahman Balogun is an assistant editor-in-chief with the Nigeria News Agency. He spoke with me from Abuja. Togolese opposition groups say they are waiting for regional leaders to help end the ongoing political crisis. This after leaders from the Economic Community of West African State, or ECOWAS, rescheduled a meeting aimed to resolve the political stalemate between the government and opposition groups. An ongoing dialogue between the two groups, facilitated by Presidents Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo from Ghana and Alpha Conde from Guinea, have stalled. The opposition says President Faure Gnassingbe is to blame for the stalled talks, an accusation the government denies. For more about the latest political development in Togo, I reach Bridget Ajamagbo-Johnson, a leading member of the opposition in the capital, Lomé.
When the head of state came on the 31st of July, they adopted a roadmap through which they are asking us to do the reforms that people are asking for, and also to reform all the electoral system to allow full participation of the opposition and to have democratic and transparent elections. And they will be there with us along the process. After the 31st of July, they sent a delegation chaired by the head of the ECOWAS Commission. They went to hear about us and explain to us what was on the roadmap. And we agreed that this monitoring committee should come and meet very quickly so that together we can identify what are the concrete tasks that we need to achieve and build an agenda.
Mrs. Ajimagbo, the government has come out to say that it is committed to the full implementation of the roadmap to resolve some of the concerns that opposition groups have raised. So why are you still displeased about it?
Because we have some indicators that show that they are trying to take control of the process because they don't agree with the roadmap, which is not favorable to the statu quo. And the version that was disseminated was not favorable at all to the people. We discovered it when we went to ECOWAS, asking them to give us the official roadmap. And second, there is something going on with which we are really concerned. They are trying to ban the mosques, you know, in Togo, which are a very special place where Muslims can pray. And they do it in some sector of the country where you have militaries there. They are there, and why is it that they could not arrest those people who go to burn the mosque? And lastly, since the week which is ending, they allowed the Electoral Commission, which is part of the problem, to start to announce that after the ECOWAS meeting, they decide to start to prepare the election, as if they didn't know that they don't have the control of the process.
The government has denied that it is trying to hijack the process or the implementation of the roadmap as agreed to by ECOWAS and both groups.
How can they deny when they publish communiques from the Electoral Commission asking political parties to send their representative members to them and to the local electoral commission, and announcing that next week they will start to register electors? You know, we know this government, and we know them. In fact, I want to take this opportunity to let them know that they should be serious this time if they want to play with Togolese destiny. We will not let them continue at all.
But some people are suggesting that despite the roadmap, the constitution has to be obeyed, and then the Electoral Commission has to prepare for elections.
The constitution itself has been integrated in the roadmap, and the government is the one who wants to call ECOWAS head of state to come and help to solve the problem. Now that they gave us a roadmap, we all have to obey and to follow this roadmap.
Bridget Ajamagbo Johnson is a leading Togolese member of the opposition. She spoke with me from Lomé. Zambian main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, has reported Faustin Banda, a parliamentary candidate, to the police over allegations of fraud. Gary Nkombo, the party's chairman for elections, who reported the case to the police, says the candidate obtained goods from the party under false pretense, which he said is illegal. Meanwhile, fearing for his family's safety, Faustin Banda has gone into hiding, citing intimidation and harassment from his own party, the UPND. For the latest development, I reached Gary Nkombo in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
On the material day, Wednesday the 8th, he did come to the office, the party headquarters, to collect his adoption certificate. And among the things he collected, together with the adoption certificate, was cash amounting to $200. And much to our chagrin, he disappeared. And the only thing that we knew was that he had not traveled to Chipata, which is about 600 kilometers east of the country. And so we definitely went into panic mode, and we tried as best we could to find the other candidates. We then decided that we're going to report the matter to the police for Dr. Faustin Banda collecting campaign materials and cash by false pretense, which in the law book of Zambia is actually a criminal offense.
But Gary, some people are suggesting that this is a pure internal matter for the UPND to deal with rather than seek what you said was a criminal activity to be done by the police, since they said this is a UPND internal party matter.
They don't understand. Those who are thinking like that do not understand, because when you say this is a UPND internal matter, what do you expect? The most we can do is to just, expel him from the party. But you should not forget that he did us wrong by pretending to be wanting to contest. And our take is that until he explains it to a court of law, we think that he collected those materials maliciously and also with intention to defraud and also with intention to defranchise our people. Because you may want to know that the people who support our party will not vote on that day.
The man, Dr. Faustin Banda, is a member of the UPND who is in good standing. The UPND has vetted him, and the UPND wanted him to be the face of the party in this by-election that you spoke about. So it is the UPND to blame for this action if indeed one of its members decided to treat the party in this manner that the party is displeased with. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think everyone has a right to their opinion. They have a right to their opinion. And if they think that it's UPND's problem to select among party members who they think they can represent them, and that member decides to be dishonest, And honest is not a matter that you can actually judge before it happens. So definitely, Dr. Banda was in good standing with the party. That's why he qualified for consideration. But he became in bad standing with the party when he disappeared. Anybody normal would have actually come and say, I do have a problem, and I would like to disengage, and it should be done in good time. And nobody would have fought with Dr. Banda. But the fact that he should have returned the materials, and, he decided now to return the materials yesterday. He actually reappeared to return the materials and the cash yesterday. And now you ask yourself a question. Did he connive with people, or did he do it by sheer, misfortune? That is now a matter that we cannot deal with as a group of people. We cannot bring him to a court because we do not have competent jurisdiction to deal with a matter such as that one. If we can only call him to a hearing, and if we are dissatisfied, we can still go to court. And the court, don't forget, Peter, is a place for recourse, isn't it? Haven't you ever heard of a brother suing a father, a brother suing a sister? You can then say that this is an internal family matter, they must sort it out. But people have gone to litigate within a nuclear family.
News coming from Zambia suggests that Dr. Faustin Banda is in hiding, afraid of his life, because some people in the UPND have called on the Akedes or their supporters to hunt him down, to hurt him, to physically harm him. How do you respond to such criticisms?
I'm ignorant to that fact. And this is the reason why I was the one who went to the police, not to his house. And I know not of any incident like that. I'm hearing from you now, and so maybe I require, if it is indeed happening, it is wrong. But I can only say that much, because I'm totally ignorant of the fact that people are hunting him down. I'm just now informing you, Peter, that he returned the materials and the cash to one party member. How did he do that if he's in hiding? So I can only imagine that particular allegation is false.
So what is the next line of action for the UPND after reporting this matter to the police to handle?
We'll wait for the police to act.
Gary Nkombo is the chairman for elections for the Zambian main opposition UPND. He spoke with me from Lusaka. In the Gambia, there's controversy over the appointment of a former Gambian U.S. Army captain hired to head the country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission's Research and Investigation Department. Former U.S. Army Captain Alhaji Baru was jailed in 2016 by a U.S. federal court together with four other naturalized U.S. citizens for taking part in an armed mutiny to overthrow the government of former President Yahya Jammeh. For VOA Pandere Mbai reports, critics of the government said Barrow's appointment will undermine the credibility of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
The 2014 coup in which Alhaji Baru took part left three of the attackers dead and one captured. He and his co-conspirators were charged under the U.S. Neutrality Act, which bars U.S. citizens from waging a war against nations at peace with the United States. Baru spent 6 months in federal prisons before he was released. 4 years later, he has landed a job at Gambia's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparation Commission, or TRC. In a statement, Babagale Jallo, the executive secretary of the commission, said Baru's job will be to oversee and direct a team of researchers and investigators. He says all of the people who applied for the job, Baru was the best candidate to handle what he called this very challenging and crucially important position. But Lamin Tamba, the spokesperson for the opposition APRC Party United Kingdom branch, disagrees. Tamba says Baru is a convicted felon and his appointment will undermine the work of the TRC.
I believe the appointment should be rescinded immediately based on a few principles of law. First and foremost, this chap decided that the only way to change a government that he disagrees with is by picking up arms and forcing a change of a democratically elected government. And apparently he was part of the people who planned and tried to execute the plot of changing Gambia's government in 2014, on the 30th of December, to be precise.
Tamba says Baru is a conflicted person and his impartiality as an investigator cannot be guaranteed.
As a victim and as a former person who's had a feud or beef with the former government, cannot sit on any panel in any capacity to investigate the former government's alleged atrocities, to investigate the former government's alleged misappropriation of our laws or extrajudicial activities that took place under APRC.
Mamadou Sabali is a former presidential affairs minister under Jammeh's government. He was arrested and subjected to degrading treatment after being fired.
Of the same Alhaji Baru in January of this year, being quoted by the Voice newspaper saying that he would have been very happy, he would not have minded if the former president beheaded me. Now, how vile can any person be? How can somebody with such a revenge mentality, with such an atrocious type of thinking, be allowed to play any role in the establishment of truth and reconciliation in New Gambia? This is completely, totally unconscionable. It's unacceptable to any right-thinking human being.
The executive secretary of the TRC, Babagale Jallo, was among the journalists exiled by Jammeh. His newspaper, The Independent, was fire bombarded by government agents before it was shut down by the state. Sabali says Jallo too is a former Jammeh victim. Sabali said Jallo's position at the TRC is untenable given his past history with Jammeh. Lamin Boj is a Gambian human rights lawyer.
To appoint somebody who has been convicted of a felonious charge in a foreign country in the Gambia, it's just like they have no regard for the rule of law. That is my take on it. Because if they have consideration for the rule of law, they would not have appointed him. It's not a sign of good governance.
Lawyer Boj notes that, given Baru's past criminal history, his appointment will no doubt scare witnesses scheduled to appear before the commission. He says in the interest of justice and fair play, the government should avoid creating a precedent that will cast doubt on the decisions of the commission. Justice Minister Abubakar Tambedu was rich for comment, but he said he was taking part in a pilgrimage to Mecca. Babagale Jallo of the TRC also was busy touring the country. For VOA Africa, this is Pandere Mbai reporting.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the International Organization for Migration reports its voluntary repatriation program in Libya is unable to keep pace with the alarmingly high number of migrants in government detention centers wishing to go home. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Migration Agency reports government-run detention centers in Libya are packed with migrants, mainly from sub-Saharan Africa. This, despite IOM's robust program to return migrants to their countries of origin. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says large numbers of refugees and migrants heading toward Europe are being intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard, brought back to shore, and placed in detention upon arrival. He says this interception, or, as some see it, rescue operation, has been so successful that the number of migrants placed in official detention centers has nearly doubled from 5,500 to 9,300 between 2017 and 2018.
IOM has made clear that we don't like detention centers as a general principle. We would like to see all of these returnees registered quickly and be allowed to live outside these centers, and if they choose, to go home on the voluntary humanitarian return program as quickly as possible. We think it could be, in many cases, as soon as a week after they're rescued.
In the first half of this year, the UN Migration Agency reports it has safely returned nearly 11,000 stranded migrants from Libya. The vast majority have been flown to countries in Central and West Africa. It says much smaller numbers of several hundreds have been returned to East and the Horn of Africa, and a few more to Asia and North Africa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Football's world governing body, FIFA, has banned Zambia's former African Football of the Year, Kalusha Bwalya, for 2 years. Its decision follows an investigation into his links to ban Qatari official Mohammed bin Hammam. It found that Bwalya had accepted a gift violating FIFA's code of ethics. In a statement, Bwalya said that he is not guilty of any offense and vowed to fight tooth and nail to clear his name. FIFA's ethics committee said the ban was from all football-related activities at both national and international level. Bwalya, a former president of the Football Association of Zambia, is a Confederation of African Football, CAF, executive committee member. FIFA said in a statement it had been investigating the 50-year-old since February last year, focused principally on benefits that Mr. Bwalya had received from Mr. Bin Hammam. Bwalya has also been fined $100,000. In 1988, Bwalya was voted African Player of the Year by CAF and later went on to be coach of the Zambian national team. In athletics, Kenya's Samuel Kalalei, who won the Athens Marathon last November, is the third athlete to have been found in breach of anti-doping rules within 2 weeks, according to officials. The 24-year-old Kalalai has been provisionally suspended by the Athletics Integrity Unit for testing positive for blood booster EPO on June 4th, according to the body's website. Kalalai's failed test is the latest to tarnish the nation's reputation as the dominant force in global middle and long distance running, as it has been dogged in recent years by doping cases among elite athletes. Sprinter Boniface Mweresa was last month dropped from the Kenyan team that topped the medal table at the African Senior Championships in Asaba, Nigeria, after he failed a doping test. Mweresa protested that he had taken declared supplements, but anti-doping agents of Kenya said the substance found in his sample was prohibited. The Continental Athletics showpiece ended on Sunday with Kenya winning 11 golds, 6 silvers, and 2 bronze. Former Commonwealth Games 10,000 meters champion and marathon runner Lucy Kabu was on August 4th suspended by the Athletics Integrity Unit for failing a dob test. Kabu, who is 34, tested positive for morphine during the Milan Marathon, which she won in April this year, 2 months after triumphing in the Hong Kong event. The athlete won 10,000 meters gold and 5,000 meters bronze at the 2006 Commonwealth Games in Melbourne, Australia. Asbel Kiprop, the former Olympic and 3 times world 1500 meters champion, is also serving a provisional suspension for testing positive for EPO. Others serving provisional suspensions are former 3-time Boston City Marathon winner Rita Jeptu and 2016 Rio Olympics marathon champion Jemina Samgong. And on a sad note, Kenya's 2015 400 meters hurdles world champion Nicholas Bett died aged 28 in a road accident on Wednesday morning. Bett's car veered off the road and landed in a ditch near Lesos along Eldoret Kapsabet Road in Nandi, North Rift, Kenya, killing him on the spot. Bett had just returned from African Championships in Asaba, Nigeria, and was driving to Nairobi. In 2015, he made history in the Beijing Championships when he became the first Kenyan to win a world gold at a distance shorter than 800 meters. He was a 2-time African bronze medalist. Finally, in tennis, unseeded youngster Stefanos Tsitsipas saved a match point before beating Kevin Anderson to set up a final against Rafael Nadal at the Rogers Cup. The Greek, who turned 20 on Sunday's final in Toronto, overcame the South African 6-7, 6-4, 7-6. The world number 27 also beat Dominic Thiem, Novak Djokovic, and Alexander Zverev in previous rounds. In the women's final, Romanian world number 1 Simone Halep will play American Sloane Stephens in Montreal. Halep beat Australian Ashleigh Barty 6-4, 6-1, while Stephens was a 6-3, 6-3 winner against Ukraine's Elena Svitolina. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Send me, yeah.
Kabale kadora, ayabingira bajungu. funny munuka. Abanyera abatunzi rabunyoro muri funny mwandara. Kimwa sabahigi muri rabukukumuka. Swansi kabale kadora ayamingira bajungu. Abanyera abaye berungu muri banyoro muri funny munuka. Abanyera abatunzi rabunyoro muri funny mwandara. Kimwa sabahigi kumka swaize kabale kadora ayavingira bajungu.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Despite the declaration by the Zimbabwean government that the country was open for business, President Trump last week signed a bill which strengthened United States sanctions against the country. The new emphasis is on recognition that there are free and fair elections, that there are improvements in human rights performance, and that there are compensation to white farmers whose lands have been seized. Sanctions by themselves are not illegal. They are provided for in the United Nations Charter. Chapter 7 of the Charter provides the Security Council with the possibility of imposing sanctions against delinquent and rogue states that may be guilty of threat to the peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression. Unfortunately, between 1945 and the end of the Cold War in the early 1980s, it was extremely difficult for the Security Council to agree on the imposition of sanctions. In fact, the African states were the most frustrated countries when they tried unsuccessfully many times to get the Security Council to impose comprehensive sanctions against white minority rule in Southern Africa, particularly the apartheid state of South Africa. Ironically, it was the Western states who insisted throughout that period that sanctions don't work, and they refuse to agree to the imposition of sanctions against apartheid South Africa. Only toward the end of white minority rule did they relented and began to pass some sanctions against South Africa, both for Namibia and South Africa, and also against Ian Smith regime. The problem now is not so much United Nations comprehensive sanctions. They are under the charter, and they have passed some effective ones against Iran and against North Korea. And there is a feeling that those two countries went to the negotiating table because of United Nations comprehensive sanctions. However, as the United States and some other countries found it difficult to get support in the Security Council, they have resorted to the imposition of unilateral sanctions. Unilateral sanctions are not binding on any other member states, and many states rejected and some even argued that they are illegal, as we have seen recently with the case of Iran, when the U.S. imposed sanctions and the European Union and many other states rejected it. But it is not easy to ignore U.S. secondary sanctions for three reasons. One, the status of the U.S. economy. The U.S. has a $23 trillion economy. It has a very expanding banking system. And thirdly, the dollar is a reserve currency in many, many countries. But as we have seen recently, countries are beginning to push back. As the European Union, for example, only a few weeks ago, promised its small and medium-sized states that they should not fear the U.S. by remaining in Iran and that they would support them. Many African states have become victims of secondary sanctions imposed by the United States and other states. Now there are moves being made by many countries. For example, China has signed swap currency agreements with many countries in Asia. They trade with the yuan instead of the dollar. And recently, China signed agreement with some African countries like Nigeria, South Africa, Ghana, for swap agreements, which allow those countries to use the yuan instead of the dollar. And many economists and financial experts have argued that over time, the biggest loser will be the United States, as many countries rely less on the United States dollar and the U.S. banking system, then things will stabilize because U.S. leverage will become less and less. So South Africans should be aware of these factors, but for the time being, we have to accept the fact that unilateral sanctions are going to apply again and again. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter and producer Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer for today, Jonah Cummings, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, giant silk cotton trees grow out of very tiny seeds. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. Why would a U.S. government agency specializing in administering civilian foreign aid and development assistance concern itself with religious freedom in the countries where it works? At USAID, we see freedom of worship as an essential element in our pursuit of government that is citizen-centered and citizen-responsive, said USAID Administrator Mark Green. It is inseparable from freedoms of expression, assembly, association, and freedom from discrimination. But a more practical reason is that faith-based organizations frequently work with USAID to deliver development assistance or humanitarian relief to marginalized people. Faith-based partners are often uniquely trusted in those forgotten communities, said Administrator Green. Religious liberty matters because it enables faith-based groups to work with USAID and others without surrendering their essential faith character. Religious intolerance, on the other hand, frequently drives violence and oppression, marginalization and persecution of entire populations. To see what unchecked intolerance looks like, we need look no further than ISIS and the atrocities it has committed. At USAID, because we really look at freedom of worship as a core human right, we're supporting programs to address religious hate speech and interfaith conflict to promote the strengthening and enforcement of laws that protect religious freedom and to increase the capacity of civil society to advocate for it, said Administrator Green. This includes technical assistance and financial support for civil society. USAID is presently undertaking reforms to its partnership and procurement process to make partnering with NGOs and civil society groups easier. At the same time, to help prevent the worst manifestations of religious intolerance before they cause harm, USAID is working to assemble metrics to measure capacity and commitment in the countries where it is active, such as the capacity of civil society and the inclusiveness of government policies. Finally, working with its partners, USAID aims to reinforce and strengthen ethnic and religious pluralism where it has historically existed. It isn't about the content of faith, it never has been, said Administrator Green. It's about society's tolerance for multiple faith traditions. We believe that religious pluralism is part of a cultural mosaic. We believe it is worth preserving as a matter of development as well as an expression of our values.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.